So I'm going to talk about trying to float all the way around the world with a whisper tracker in this presentation. Kind of a little bit of background. I think most people are familiar with latex weather balloons on the left here. Hams have been launching these for a very long time. I launched a bunch in college, and we've launched several here in the Bay Area. As you can see, that huge tank of gas there, and the very big balloon, these balloons can carry up to 12 pounds of payload, up to about 100,000 feet. And then they pop and everything falls down and you go and collect it. What I'm going to talk about today is floating superpressure balloons, which is what David is holding up on the right side. The material is not latex. It's a plastic film, and it doesn't expand. Oh, I'll get into that. So just a little bit about the differences between high altitude balloons, which are bursting, and the superpressure balloons, which I'm going to be talking about. As I said before, the flight duration for the high altitude balloons is relatively short. They go up fast, they pop, they fall down. And you can go collect them wherever they fall. If you launch it from kind of the bay here, they usually land in the Central Valley, which is great because you can drive pretty much to wherever they fall and pluck it out of a tree. Yeah, for comms, you usually use APRS, which I think most people are familiar with, on 2 meters. And yeah, they usually use batteries for power, and it's kind of a short duration thing. Superpressure balloons are a bit different because they kind of go up to a certain altitude, which you can calculate, and then they just float. And they float with the jet streams, and they float for a very long time, hopefully. If it doesn't hit any weather, these balloons are above most of the weather, except for thunderstorms. And except for really tall thunderstorms. So there's really nothing that can prevent them from being up there for a long time. So long or around the world, long endurance, they're constant about 38,000 feet to 42,000 feet. They can go higher. NASA goes higher. But those are very expensive and very big balloons. The superpressure balloons that we're launching, you know, the payload is 10 to 20 grams, which is not a lot. So you got to squeeze everything down and lighten it up. Luckily, you know, electronics and PCBs nowadays are light and cheap. For comms, they use Whisper, which is the weak signal propagation reporting system, which I'll get into. And these are disposable. We never recover these. So they go up and they start floating, and when they crash somewhere, fall out of the sky. They use multi-layer plastics, and they don't have batteries on board. Batteries are just too heavy. And then science opportunities, we're still trying to figure out what kind of cool things we could do with regards to science for these superpressure balloons. So the question is, you know, like, why are we trying to do a superpressure balloon? The HESF high altitude balloon team has launched several regular bursting balloons, as I said before. We've had cameras, a crossband repeater, which is pretty cool because you can get half the state talking on a crossband repeater. You know, 2 meters, 440 FM. I've also flown LoRa. They're lots of fun, but it's expensive for the balloon. And, you know, helium is very expensive now. The picture on the right there is a launch we did in Lodi, sorry, in Davis, California. You know, and that's, you know, the balloon is, you know, almost $100, and the helium is a couple hundred dollars. And so this is kind of a big operation dollars wise. You know, we also wanted to have a new challenge, and this was kind of a pandemic project in the beginning of the pandemic. We're like, hey, let's try something else. And the goal is to try and make it around the world. The longest duration pico balloon, amateur radio pico balloon that we know of is a little over 300 days, and it's been around the world 12 times, which I think is pretty cool. But we're trying to just go around once, and we're not quite there yet. So a little bit about superpressure balloons. If you're not familiar with what they are, the balloon is a material is rigid. It's not like a latex party, you know, happy birthday balloon that you might have. So these balloons do not stretch when they get up to altitude. So the volume of the balloon is kept constant. And kind of the analogy I like to use is boats. You know, you have a heavy steel boat, but it still floats on the ocean because the weight of the steel and everything in the boat is less than the weight of the displaced water. So you replace the air with a little bit of water and the boat starts to get lower and lower and lower. And then you put too much water in the boat and it sinks. You go below the water and, you know, you're talking about submarines, right? Submarines float on the surface. You ballast them up with heavy water and water that is heavy, I should say. And then they sink, right? And they go down to a particular depth and they just kind of cruise around the world at that depth. The idea is the same, except you're up in the atmosphere. So you have a specified volume and you float up and then you're there and you just kind of float at that same pressure for as far as you can float. Bigger balloon provides more lift and can go higher. This picture on the right is one of the NASA superpressure balloons that floated around Antarctica for a couple of weeks several years ago. So the other thing with superpressure balloons is that they look empty when they're released, and I've got a picture of that later. So the other part of the puzzle besides the balloon side was the electronics side. There are several commercial off-the-shelf vendors that provide Pico balloon trackers, but they are also $100 or more. And so Martin built and designed his own. It's pretty cheap. There's a picture there on the right side. You can see the GPS in the upper left corner. The microprocessor kind of in the bottom left corner, and the transmitter is on the right side there. There are the specs. It's 12 grams, 2 inches by 4 inches roughly. It's 18 mega 328 for the processor. There's not much going on with the processor. It has a UART to talk to the GPS and uses I2C to talk to the oscillator. I mean, it's just an oscillator, 10 milliwatt oscillator, which we're using as our whisper transmitter. There's the part number for the oscillator, and there's also a temperature controlled crystal oscillator on there because whisper is pretty frequency intolerant. So we got to be right on frequency. It's using a U-Box knockoff GPS. The monopole GPS antenna there is black at the top, which actually works pretty well. And as I said before, this is solar cells only, no batteries. So this only works during the day and that's it. At night, it goes dormant and kind of floats along until the sun rises far enough where it can power on and transmit. So here's a little bit more about our superpressure balloons. There is a company, Scientific Balloon Systems, that sells these SBS-13 balloons. They're $130 a piece. Very expensive. Somebody in the Pico balloon community found out that these AliExpress party balloons straight from China, $2 each, work pretty darn well. So that's what we've been doing. Unfortunately, they are cheap and quality control is not the highest. So you do have to pressure test them and make sure that they are working before you launch them. And I think it's like a third of the balloons have some minor defect that would not be noticeable, for their intended usage, which is party balloons, for a day. But once you inflate them, they might have a small pinhole leak. And, after a couple of days, they deflate, which is what normal balloons do. But we want it to go for a very long time. So we fill it with hydrogen, which is much cheaper than helium and provides more lift. 7 grams of hydrogen per balloon is not a lot. You can see everybody can see that, I guess, on the right side there. That's Rob holding two of these AliExpress balloons. They don't look full, but there is a little bit of lift in there. We have used these balloons for 20 launches. And I didn't include a lot of information on the balloons in this talk, but we did do a whole presentation on this at PacificCon back in, what was that, October? And so that is online. So check it out if you're all interested. The picture in the bottom right is kind of what the balloon looks like when it's fully inflated. So it expands quite a bit there. So this is kind of our results. The first one, WB6TOU-13, that David did with an SBS 13 balloon and a commercial tracker, went around the world 2.5 times. It finally landed here in Iran, and that was the last we heard from it. So probably a pinhole leak or something happened, and it fell out of the sky. Since the SBS 13 balloons are pretty expensive, we switched to using these AliExpress balloons and Martin's tracker, Custom Electronics, and this was in September of last year. We went from California all the way to Turkmenistan with a loop in the Pacific. And interestingly enough, summer times in the northern hemispheres, the winds are not kind of meander all over the place. And so going around the world is not super, it's not fast to go around the world in the summertime. But in the wintertime, it's much quicker to go around the world, which we will see shortly. The next kind of balloon we did in October went up to Iceland before we lost track of it. And then this was our most recent balloon that worked in just before Christmas of this year. So we launched it from, you know, Berkeley, and it went all the way to the Midway Islands. Interesting, we lost comms with it for 2 days when it was over China and Kazakhstan and Kazakhstan and Mongolia and Iran and that part of the world. Not quite sure why there's not a lot of whisper receivers in that part of the world. And they also do a bunch of jamming of GPS. So it could be either one of those, and not quite sure which. So to talk about the comms a little bit more, for Pika balloons and for high altitude balloons, the bursting latex balloons, there's kind of two modes of communication that are used. I think most everyone is familiar with APRS, 2 meters, line of sight, 1200 baud, relatively low power, and it's all line of sight. And the telemetry, the payload of each APRS packet, you know, you can kind of put anything in. And, you know, in the beginning, APRS just used to be about location, but now there's a whole bunch of stuff stuffed into the payload of the APRS packet, which is super interesting. So the only problem with APRS is that it is line of sight, and we're trying to go around the world here. And so when it's out in the middle of the ocean, we're not going to be able to know where the balloon is or how far it's been. So the system that we use is the Weak Signal Propagation Reporting System, WSPR, which you may be familiar with. It's usually on 20 meters, although there are WSPR segments in all of the HF amateur bands. It's 50 bits for the entire payload, and it transmits over 2 minutes, which is pretty interesting. I mean, it's designed for propagation, measuring propagation between two points on the Earth. And so we're kind of using this mode not in its intended usage, but it still works pretty darn well. The bandwidth is much smaller. It's only 50 bits per packet. Power is very low. 10 milliwatts is what we're running, you know, up to about 10 watts of transmit power. Most people don't do more than 5 or 10 watts only because that's the lowest that a regular HF, you know, all mode transceiver will do. If it could do 1 watt, most people would probably use 1 watt transmit power. And really the only information in a WSPR packet is your call sign, the grid square where you are transmitting from and the power output that you're transmitting. So just a little bit more about Whisper. It was invented by Joe Taylor, I think 10 plus years ago, and it was designed to test propagation at HF. And I already talked about the power output. You know, our transmitter is 10 milliwatts of RF power. It's essentially an oscillator. And, you know, our signal has gone pretty much halfway around the world. Our max distance for a Whisper packet from a balloon that's been received was 19,800 kilometers, you know, and the, you know, halfway around the world is 20,000 kilometers. So we were only about 200 kilometers short of going halfway around the world, which is pretty interesting. We don't know if, you know, a Whisper packet goes the long way or the short way. So certainly Whisper could go for more than 20,000 kilometers, but we don't know. There's no way to tell whether it's long path or short path. The total transmit duration for a single Whisper packet is 2 minutes long, and it's 50 bits of actual payload data. And that gets expanded out to 162 bits with all the forward error correction that gets added to this signal. And it's a four array FSK. Here is kind of a picture of what the Whisper band looks like. This is WSJTX, which is software written by Joe Taylor. And this is on the left is, you know, 0 hertz, and to the right is, you know, 2500 hertz. This is audio bandwidth that we're looking at here. So that green part centered around 1500 hertz is where the Whisper band is, and you can see all those lines, and each one of those lines is one single Whisper packet that's transmitting. And we're looking at about 5 minutes of time here. So the distance between the horizontal green lines is 2 minutes. And you can see that, I don't know if you can see my mouse there. But so this bottom, time frame here at 2132. So there's 10 Whisper packets in this small little segment here, and you can only see maybe five or six of them, and they're all on top of each other. And they're also maybe very weak. This middle time frame here, the middle time frame here had, which is 2134, had 10 packets, and you can see they're spaced out a little bit more. That's kind of what you look at. That's kind of what you see when you look at the Whisper band. It's this 2 minute long transmission, as opposed to, let's say, FT8, which is, you know, 15 seconds or so. So, we use Whisper cause it's on HF and it goes long distances. We did use APRS in the beginning. We had both transmitters on the tracker electronics. We used a piano wire antenna straight down, but we had a lot of RFI issues and we were jamming ourselves. Sometimes when we transmitted an APRS packet, we caused a microcontroller to lock up. And for various reasons, we basically had to power cycle the entire tracker before it would come back alive, which is fine when it's on the bench. But here, you know, we're up floating up at, 28 or 30,000 feet or 35,000 feet. The only way to turn it off and turn it back on is to wait until it goes into the darkness and powers down, and then wait until the morning. And so that wasn't too sustainable for us, because since we also had the Whisper transmitter, we knew where it was down to, you know, a regular Maidenhead grid square. We didn't need the APRS, the more precise APRS position location information. So we dropped the APRS packet. Just looking at the data, it's kind of interesting to think about, the joules per packets here. For APRS, you know, maybe it's you're transmitting a watt of power, and an APRS packet is maybe a second long. So we're looking at 1 joule per packet of energy per packet. And, you know, a joule divided by 1,000 bits of data or so is, you know, 0.001 joules per bit. Whisper has much lower power, transmit power, 10 milliwatts instead of a watt, but we're transmitting for such a long time that the energy per packet is actually the same, which is pretty interesting. And because we have so many less bits, the energy per bit is actually much higher. And you couple that with the lower frequency, and you can get a lot more distance out of a whisper packet. And this helps us when we're out in the middle of the ocean, far away from any receivers. So that's kind of interesting. That's an interesting fact. So how can I get involved? If you're all interested, we do have this SFHAB mailing list. And we also have a channel on the San Francisco Amateur Radio Club Slack. And yeah, we'd love to have you come and join us. We are looking for new sensors to fly on both Pico balloon and high altitude balloon projects. Different cameras, different sensors. You know, people are interested in, an inertially stabilized platform to do some cool science, or cameras, or look up, at the sky. Maybe also a VLF downloader that flies up in the atmosphere for a short time. The super pressure balloons that we launch, the payload mass is not too much. So whatever sensor that we fly, has to be pretty darn light and not consume a lot of power. So that's an interesting, problem also. There's also the groups.io Pico Balloon email list, which is a good resource. Lots of people on that swapping ideas. And it seems that around the United States and the world, there's, a Pico Balloon launched, several launches per week, that people are launching, SBS balloons, these AliExpress balloons, different types of balloons, different ideas, different trackers. So it's kind of an experimenting, experimenting forum. And the other thing that you can do is to help out these Pico balloons is set up a whisper receiving station. I have a TS-2000 and it's, idle for not even 95. It's 98% of the time, 99% of the time. And so I just tune up WSJTX and just let it decode whisper. And so any other Pico balloons that are floating around the world, I receive them and then forward the info onto the whisper database. And then the owners of the Pico balloons can look at where their balloon is. So, which is pretty cool. Maybe I'll take a break. And is there any questions about Pico balloons right now? Because I'm just going to shift topics just a little bit.
There's a question from Scott. Scott asks, what is the detail behind 20 meter as the most popular whisper band? It looks like whisper transmitters can band hop. Wouldn't that be a way to see how many bands are doing? Why just one band?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We are actually, maybe I can go back to the first slide here. So it basically boils down to antenna weight, which is pretty interesting. So Martin here on the left has the tracker in his hand and he's got a toilet paper roll there. And on that roll, which you can barely see, is 18 or 20 feet of 36 gauge wire.
Wow.
And that's what I'm holding there also, but we put a little bit of fishing line and super glue the fishing line to the antenna just for a little bit more strength there. So a 40 meter antenna will be great, except for it's double the weight. And doubling the weight on this means that it's not going to fly. So I have a blog post online about the weights involved, but I think that the mass of both antennas was about 3 grams. And, you know, doubling that to 6 grams means that we would float at a much lower altitude. And there's, you know, a spreadsheet that, you can calculate the altitude, but we would be, you know, in the actual weather, thunderstorms and high clouds. So we would not fly as high as we need to kind of float above all of the bad weather. And weather is usually the thing that brings these Pico balloons down. Any rain on the top side of this balloon or the tracker means that it's too heavy and it falls out of the sky. So any moisture on there, ice buildup, all that stuff, you know, you add a gram and all of a sudden you start sinking and sinking and then your balloon falls out of the sky. So yeah, we've stand around 20 meters, basically due to antenna weight. A few of our trackers also transmitted on 30 meters, which was really interesting. Which is 10 megahertz. And that worked pretty well, even though the antenna, you know, is not resonant at all. So, yeah, great question though.
What altitude does it actually get up to? And what's the temperature? And does the temperature have any impact on the circuitry?
So I pulled out the slide from our Pacificon presentation, but we're floating right around, 32 to 36,000 feet. And it's really cold up there. So all of the parts that we use are industrial rated. All the parts are fine. The temperature controlled crystal oscillator, that's the hard part. The TCXO is the hard part. And you have to use the TCXO because it's so cold up there that a regular crystal, you'd be way out of tolerance, way out of spec, and you'll be transmitting not within the whisper band, which is only 200 hertz wide. And if you're not transmitting within that whisper band, then all the receiving stations don't hear you. So.
Kevin asks, how do you coordinate with commercial air traffic?
So we don't, we're flying above that. That's a great question. They're also, the payload that we have here is also so light that it is not on, anybody's radar, literally and figuratively. The FAA doesn't care about this. It's too small. We don't coordinate with any of them. It just floats wherever it is.
Scott asks, are these balloons used for any particular scientific purpose?
Not yet. But that's kind of one of the things that we're interested in doing, is what type of sensor could we fly that's light enough that would be cool. So there's several ideas on the Pico Balloon email list, looking at maybe radiation monitor in the upper atmosphere, but we're not quite sure. There are whisper. There is science being done with whisper with propagation, based on the whisper protocol. And we kind of fit into that, Any other quick questions? All right. So I'm going to shift gears a bit and talk about radiosondes. So when we're launching a Pico balloon, we use this thing on the right side, the picture there on the right side called High Split, which is a program that NOAA puts out. And you can, predict where your Pico balloon is going to float. 10,000 meters there is the blue line. So at this time, when this model was run, after a couple of days, we would be out, off the coast of, wherever that is, New Jersey or wherever. And so the question is, how do we know what's happening in the upper atmosphere? Where is the jet stream going? We've got these cool maps online where you can see, it's going to be windy today. It's not going to be windy tomorrow. Where does all this information come from? And the answer is it comes from radiosondes. which are small devices that get launched on a latex bursting balloon. They measure the upper atmosphere winds, temperature, humidity, and that data gets fed back into this huge global forecast system model. And that model is used to predict all the stuff that I just talked about. Weather predictions, you know, is it going to rain tomorrow? When's that Pineapple Express going to come and hit us? Volcanic ash, manned hot air balloons, wildfire smoke out in the Sierras. And this is what a radiosonde looks like. You know, it's about 8 inches long. So it's pretty small. It's only 84 grams, pretty light. It's encased in styrofoam. And I just want to say that, you know, this is not amateur radio, but it's ham adjacent. So these transmit at 403 megahertz or 1680 megahertz. And this Vaisala RS-41 here transmits 60 milliwatts at 403 megahertz. And these are the ones that get launched from Oakland International Airport twice a day. And here's the launcher at Oakland International Airport. So, you know, at 3 a.m. and 3 p.m. Pacific time now, until we transition into daylight savings time, one of these radiosondes gets launched out of Oakland, and it goes up for 90 minutes up to about 100,000 feet. The latex balloon pops, and then the radiosonde just free falls down and crashes somewhere and hits the ground, and then that's it. And the National Weather Service doesn't want these. So they're just kind of, you know, abandoned in place. They're trash. They're disposable. There's a ton of launch sites all around the world. I think there's like 1300 launch sites around the world that launch a radiosonde twice a day. Here's the map of the launch sites in North America. Yeah, there's a link for that. And so there's this open source software online called Radiosonde Auto RX, which you can use just an SDR, RTL SDR dongle and receive these radiosondes and look at the temperature and the altitude and the wind speeds as it's ascending and descending. And so this, I stumbled on this project about a year and a half ago, and it's been fun just to listen to the Oakland radiosondes here and see where they land. There's also a TTGO version of this that runs on a ESP32 chipset. If you don't want to have a, if you don't want to use one of these RTL SDR dongles. There's this whole worldwide network called SondHub that all the data gets fed into. And this was a screenshot from a while back on all of the balloons that were up in the air at that particular time and all the receiving stations, or which are the green dots. And one there on Null Island, which somebody forgot to correct. Yeah, so, you know, in terms of the radiosondes launched from Oakland, you know, where do they land? And you can kind of see the bay in here, but they basically land all over the place. This is, you know, about 800 radiosondes, the final landing location that were launched from Oakland. And, you know, they just go wherever the wind takes them. And so, you know, if, you know, in the South Bay, here's kind of a zoom in on where all the radiosondes have landed in the South Bay. And it's rare enough that when they do land in the South Bay, somebody usually tries and grabs them because it's pretty fun to go and pick it up. You know, if it lands in a, you know, in the populated area, it's usually easy to pick up because there's roads everywhere. But also, as you can see, there's a lot of radiosondes. Most of the radiosondes actually land, you know, out in the middle of nowhere in the forest, which, I mean, you can also go pick up, but there's, you know, private property and not a lot of roads out there. So it's a lot of fun to go and watch the sonde fall and predict where it's going to land and then go pick it up. So in terms of chasing and recovering a Radiosonde, here's the station that I use. It's just a mag mounts on the roof of the car with an RTL SDR dongle and my laptop. And it's always helpful to have somebody else drive so you can navigate. And always ask for permission if it lands on private property. But you know, if it lands in a city, there's a good chance it's going to land on a road or in a parking lot or some other public area. And here's some of the ones that I've collected. And as you can see, they have all fallen on roads. The one on the upper left was in Sunnyvale in the morning. Bottom left was actually in the middle of a road. And I was there about 2 minutes after it hit the ground and a car had already run over it, which was kind of a bummer. Parking lots and roads. The one in the upper right is Bernal Hill here in San Francisco. I just biked over and picked up that one. Car had run over the latex balloon there in the street, but the electronics were actually up on the hill. So I recovered that. So it's just a lot of fun to see it and go pick it up. So what can you do with it? It's got the National Weather Service doesn't want these back. And it's got a bunch of stuff on it. You know, it's got two AA lithium batteries. It's got a ST micro electronics processor. It uses a Silicon Labs FSK transmitter. There's a GPS on there. There's a pressure sensor. Mm-hmm. You can actually reprogram these. There's several projects online where you can just reprogram it for 430 megahertz APRS. That's pretty cool. There's a team down in San Diego that grabs these, reprograms them for the ham bands, and then does STEM outreach with the local high school where they launch one a week and then go out and try and recover it. So that's pretty fun. There's also special Radiosonde launches here in the Bay Area. When we have an atmospheric river in the winter times, which hopefully we'll have soon, maybe not. UCSD launches a bunch of Radiosondes from Bodega Bay and also just north of Yuba City. And then whenever there's a rocket launch at Vandenberg, there's a bunch of Radiosondes get launched to look at the upper atmosphere winds to make sure that the rocket won't get blown, you know, out of the acceptable area that it can fly. So you kind of know when a rocket launch is happening at Vandenberg. There's also a team doing weather measurements in Monterey Bay. And then also when we have these big wildfires, they launch Radiosondes to look at the upper atmosphere winds. Where's the smoke going to blow for smoke predictions? So that's kind of cool to watch all that stuff. If you're interested in Radiosondes, you know, the Sondhub website has a live view of where all the Radiosondes are in the sky right now. And there's also a bunch of information and resources on that website about how to track it. You can also set up a Radiosonde receiving station. It's super easy to do. You just need an RTL SDR dongle, which are really cheap. They're only $25, and a Linux computer. So that's fun to do. The hardest part is probably the antenna. A regular amateur band, 70 centimeters quarter wave whip will probably, works fine. 5/8 wave, not so much. But if you're also interested, building your own handmade quarter wave vertical is also super easy and it works really well. That was kind of all I had. There's a whole bunch more information about our Pico balloons on my blog there. I've done a blog post for every launch that we've done. And also the SF Hab group has a bunch of information about the actual balloon, super pressure balloon, testing it and inflating it and how to do it and measure lift and all that stuff. That's kind of what I got. Do we have any questions?
Well, the one question I have, Brian, is in the back of your mind, if you, when you think about the future, what would be kind of the next greatest improvement you would like to see on one of your payloads?
Some very interesting sensor, I think would be really cool. I'm not quite sure what the interesting sensor is. Radiation sensors were interesting to me. You know, what is the sun doing? We kind of can already see that with Whisper. You know, when is the band open? When is it closed? But you know, radiation, you know, high altitude radiation. We'd like to go around the world at least once, and then we can, or a couple times. But yeah, it's a very interesting question, because the Pico balloons that we're flying are, you know, that are so light, and the payloads have to be so small. You know, adding another 20 feet of or 40 feet of 34 gauge wire is too heavy. So yeah, you know, the sensor's got to be really light. But that's not to say we can't build a bigger super pressure balloon. So David has flown several SBS 13 balloons. And so that's also maybe an area of research, is building our own super pressure balloon that's much bigger and cheaper than what we can do. And then we can have much heavier payloads.
You mentioned that you're using hydrogen. Are there any safety issues with hydrogen?
So that's a great question. You know, we see the videos online of these hydrogen balloons, you know, bursting in the Hindenburg, you know, exploding all over everything. And there's a couple of differences between that kind of stuff and what we're doing. The hydrogen balloons that you see on the videos are actually usually also filled with oxygen. You need the oxygen, you know, to make the flame. We're using pure hydrogen in there. So this is not like an explosive balloon. If it were to catch, you know, if there was, you know, if there was somebody smoking nearby or something like that. The other thing is that the pressure in these super pressure balloons, as you saw in the picture there that Rob was holding, you know, there's actually not a lot of hydrogen in it. And so there's also not like an explosive, there's not a lot of hydrogen mixing with oxygen in the air to cause that fire. There, if you search online pretty hard, you can actually find this exact balloon an AliExpress balloon, somebody filled it with just a little bit of hydrogen and lit it on fire. And it kind of sits there and kind of flames look out the top, and then all the hydrogen is gone and it just kind of falls to the ground. So, yes, if you have, you know, a latex balloon that's squeezing, and then you pop that, and then now there's all of a sudden, you know, there's a lot of, you know, hydrogen pushing out, mixing with the oxygen, and then lighting off. Yes, you can have big explosions. But for these, no, there's not really an explosion risk. There's a small fire risk, but you know, no smoking nearby.
Brian, I got a question.
Yeah.
Back in 1959. I was working for DuPont. They made a product called Mylar, and they could aluminize it or make it with a metal coating film. And yep, it was used for the Echo satellite. There was a passive RF reflector satellite that went around the Earth. You ever see any data as to what kind of, whether you could use Mylar?
Mylar balloons are frowned upon because of something, and I forget exactly what, but I think it's got to do with heating and cooling, in the atmosphere, like on the daily cycle. Do they heat up more or less? I forget. I think the Mylar balloons are also just a little bit heavier, than the multi-layer plastics. So I don't think there have been any Pico balloon, amateur radio Pico balloon, Mylar super pressure balloons that have launched.
I was just curious because they made Mylar from the thickness of Saran wrap.
Yeah.
To like 3/16 of an inch thick. So
yeah,
it's pretty, got pretty good properties. I was just curious.
Yeah. Don't use it. And I can't exactly remember why.
Thanks.
Yeah. Feel free. I should have put my email on the slides, which I forgot to do, but.
So
yeah,
I had a question. You said you used two of those balloons per launch. I was just wondering, is two a practical limit? Cause is that another way to get your weight to your load bearing weight up a little bit, is to put additional balloons on the tether?
Yeah. So, you can do three, but there's, there's only a little bit more that you get with three, because at the end of the day, you're super pressuring at a particular altitude, and all of those balloons are going to super pressure at the same altitude. So, you can't go any higher with more balloons because the volume is going to be the same. And so they're going to float at the same altitude. You, now having another balloon will get you up to that altitude faster. No, unfortunately not. The way to have a heavier payload, you need to have more gas for less material, because it's actually the material weight that's the problem. So that SBS balloon can have a little bigger payload because the mass of the material is the mass to, you know, lifting ratio, I guess, is better. So yeah, I'm not, that wasn't the clearest explanation for your question. But yeah, it's basically like an R squared versus R cubed problem, right? You know, you've got your surface area versus volume on the inside, right? You want more volume. You don't want any more surface area because surface area is weight. So how do you have the most volume for the least surface area sphere? So yeah, I guess that's a better explanation.
Any other questions?
Brian, I've got a question. Have there been any international treaties about, do some countries object to having people fly these objects over their airspace? Has there ever been any discussion about that?
Yeah, great question. So yes, North Korea, there's a couple other countries. But basically what we do is, since we can't control where they go, we don't transmit over those countries. So in terms of like, you know, airspace, not flying through the airspace, there's not much we can do, but we do not transmit over North Korea because we are not authorized to transmit, you know, as amateur radio operators over North Korea. Interestingly enough, England also prohibits balloon transmissions on amateur radio. So you can't put even an APRS transmitter on a balloon and fly it in England, which is super interesting to me. So they're actually using LoRa for Pico balloons launched from England. So, or they just don't transmit over England. They go to France or whatever and launch from there.
Do you program it to sense the GPS position?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, there's geofencing, you know, if it's within these certain coordinates, don't transmit. Also, if you have a 2 meter APRS transmitter, 144.39 is not a standard APRS frequency around the world. So in Europe, they use 144.99 or something like that. I forget. They use a different frequency. So when you're using a 2 meter APRS transmitter, You also do the geofencing for the transmit frequency so that you can be heard by the APRS network in those other countries. So yes. Yeah. There's a little bit of code on in the processor that, it has a GPS, so it knows where it is and says, okay, don't transmit now.
Do you know why England forbids that?
No. And I think it's, from the olden days of, probably World War I or II or something like that. And there's been a couple of robust debates on the Pico balloon email list recently about, changing the law and what happens if we just break the law, yada, yada, yada. So.
Thank you. Yep.
Yeah.
Have there been another question is, have there been any, I'm just wondering what would happen if one of these was sucked into a jet engine,
Yeah.
Have there been any studies on that?
It's, it's only 12 grams and about that big. I'm not sure, certainly smaller than a bird. And so I don't think there's been any specific, electronics going through jet engines, but I know that they test it for birds and, it's okay for a bird to pass through, a jet engine, mostly without causing too much damage. So,
tell that to Captain Sullenberger.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So yeah, exactly. I think
that was a flock.
Yeah, I think that was more than one goose, and those goose were ginormous. But yeah.
Last chance. Any other questions?
Yeah, if you're interested more about the Pico balloon stuff, I encourage you to check out our Pacificon presentation. David WB6TOU, who's on the call, talked at length about inflating the balloons and pressure testing them and how much hydrogen you need and all that stuff. The it's on my blog. There's also on YouTube. The video is there. So yeah, check it out.
Well, thank you, Brian. We really appreciate your presentation.